Hello and welcome to the Mushing Podcast. This is your host, Robert Forto, and we are starting a brand new series today. I want to introduce you to Rod Perry. He is an Iditarod veteran, an author, and a, quote, historical interpreter in downtown Anchorage for the Anchorage Mushing District. This guy has stories that go way back. He ran in the first Iditarod in 1973, again in 74, and in 1977. And in this series, we're going to talk all about the history of the race, the Iditarod, mushing in general, and much more. Stay tuned.
Nobody covers dog sledding like Mushing from First Paw Media. Our team of athletes, volunteers, race organizers, and mushers like Robert and Michelle Forto brings you closer to the sport. If it's happening, we are there. Live from the qualifying races in January and February, the Iditarod in March, and in the summer, Mushing takes you on the road with our team and trail tour. We connect you with a history of the sport, in-depth interviews with the top mushers, and great storytelling and breaking news all year long. Follow on mushing.com.
Hello and welcome everybody to the Mushing Podcast. This is Robert, and today I am joined by a special guest. This guy knows the history of mushing in Alaska. His name is Rod Perry. Rod, how's it going today?
Well, it's going fine. All that's left of me, anyway.
Well, I'm excited to jump into this. We've talked a few times over the last year or two about having you on the show and talking about mushing history, Iditarod, Fur Rondi, the Anchorage Mushing District, your role as the historical interpreter, as you're known there on 4th Avenue for all of the summer tourists here in Anchorage. Let's jump right into this, Rod. Can you briefly tell us who you are and what you're all about? Because we're going to jump into your backstory here in a second, but just give people a little bit of a flavor of who I'm talking to today.
Okay. I grew up in Oregon, the son of a father who grew up in the foothills of the Canadian Rockies west of Calgary among the Sarsi, one of the Blackfoot sub-tribes. He never had a pair of shoes on until he was 12, all Sarsi moccasins. Now, their homestead and trap line was right among the Sarsi, and so I had those wonderful stories of the Canadian North with me. My mother grew up on a land claim in New Mexico territory, so neither of my parents, they both had to be naturalized. Well, I guess my mom really would automatically be when New Mexico became a state. But anyway, those homestead type backgrounds, I lived in a little tiny community right on the Oregon coast, Oceanside. Back then, a little town of 175 fronted. I could throw a rock into the surf at high tide. And in back of the house was 1,000-year-old forest, a great place to learn wood skills from a dad that was just such a woodsman. People ask me, when did you come to Alaska, or when did you become an Alaskan? And I usually tell them, well, I was an Alaskan from about age 8. I just wasn't old enough to run away yet. My dad had come up on a year-long construction project helping build Eielson Air Force Base, rode home every day, and I was hooked. So as soon as I was old enough with a college degree in my pocket, I came north. So first trip up was 63, went back, finished school, came up for good in 67. Just 1 month after that famous race held out of Wasilla, the Alaska centennial celebration race of our purchase of Alaska from Russia. My dad had told me a whole lot about mushing during his year up here, but I wasn't really into the mushing community yet, until a buddy of mine that I'd elk hunted with down in Oregon showed up, and he immediately got into sled dogs, and I would run from near Anchorage out to his Kinnick Road location and drag dogs with him. So I was visiting him one time, and I believe it was the winter of 1970, visiting him. He lived right on the shore of Nancy Lake, right where part of the parking is right now on the lake ice for the Iditarod restart. And so I was visiting him for this Willow Winter Carnival, decided I'd walk over from his place to the carnival headquarters. And as I was walking, I noticed a friend of mine talking with a little group of I think about three guys. I went over to say hi. It was Tom Johnson. So those of you who are into Iditarod history will recognize the name of Tom Johnson. And as I walked up, I recognized one of the guys that I'd watched run the rendezvous once. It was Joe Reddington. I'd never met him. And another guy turned out to be Dan Seavey. I'd never met him. I'd been helping coach wrestling at Diamond. And so I knew that Dan was wrestling coach at Sword, but I never met the guy. And so met those two and Dick Gillen from Chistochina. And the topic of their conversation just practically levitated me. As I speak now, the hair on the back of my neck is standing up still at this day at the thrill of it. I knew the Alaska I wished I could have come up to find. I knew it had passed 20 years before. And all of a sudden, here was this unbelievable throwback. And man, it was my chance to sign up for the Lewis and Clark expedition. I was hooked. And so I'd been driving dogs, but I hadn't really been hooked.
You grew up in Oregon, moved to Alaska. You said you had a college degree in your pocket. Was this truly a vagabond trip? I know you said your dad had come up for construction, but what was the reason for coming up? Did you take a position up here? Were you looking for gold, as they say? What was the reason for moving to Alaska in the first place?
No, I was cutting ties with Oregon. I was moving to Alaska for life, mainly for the hunting and fishing and other adventure. My degree was in wildlife management, but I didn't come up with. I had worked for the Department of Fish and Game in the one trip I had made a summer job while in college. But anyway, I came up mainly, actually, my goal was to make outdoor motion pictures, which I eventually did. That was just totally immersing myself in a life of adventure. That was my goal.
And you had mentioned in very quick passing there, Rod, about living in Anchorage, running dogs up to Wasilla, Kinnick Lake. You talked about Nancy Lake, which is literally across the highway from where I'm sitting right now. The Iditarod restart, where it's held right now in Willow, the Willow Winter Carnival. There's a lot of history there. And of course, you mentioned a couple of well-known names in our sport with Dan Seavey, Mr. Johnson, and Joe Reddington. Of course, we're going to jump into that Iditarod history in a second. But you said, my goodness, you found your calling, so to speak. You had no idea what that was yet, but you knew your life was about to change. But let's take a step back with that and lead up to how the Iditarod came about. Can you give us a kind of a brief history of that? You mentioned the 1967 race, but what led up to that, to your knowledge?
The thing that led up to the 67 race was Joe Reddington, when he came up, he got land without even knowing there was such a thing as the Iditarod Trail. He got land right atop where the Iditarod came out from the interior to the navigational supply stop on Upper Cook Inlet for all of the mining going on in the interior. and so his land overlaid the Iditarod Trail exactly. And then he took out land also out at Flathorn Lake later, and doggone if he didn't land again right beside the Iditarod Trail farther out. He was using that old trail, what you know he could find of it, was getting pretty overgrown, but they were using it to trot back and forth between their two locations. And Dorothy Page came up with an idea for a race to commemorate Alaska's centennial, contacted Joe, and she was the flickering match, he was the conflagration, he was the bonfire. Without Joe, she could have done nothing. he had so many contacts in so many areas, military, government, native population, just on and on and on. And he made that race happen. But he went out to Unalakleet in 1970, I believe it was summer of 69 or 70. And instead of being welcomed by a dog team behind every cabin, as he had been before, there in his favorite native village, he looked around distraught and saw the dogs had been replaced by a shiny yellow machine behind every cabin, and didn't dream there was anything he could do about it. It was just so saddening to him. But then later the idea came to him, wow, what about holding a long race over the Iditarod Trail? He and Vi and others had been writing to this new, fairly new government movement toward national trails, and they hadn't been getting anywhere at all with this old forgotten Gold Rush Trail in faraway Alaska. And he thought, wow, if we could run a race over that, that would bring attention to the trail, and also who's going to be best at it right off the bat? It's going to be Alaska's natives, and that'll engender a lot of pride. Maybe we'll get, I mean, nobody's going to go back to the dog team wholesale, just like farmers in the South 48 weren't going to go back to the horse and ox when they had had a tractor. But he figured here and there in a lot of the villages, you'd find somebody that wanted to run the Iditarod, and you'd have at least a smattering of the signature symbol of the native culture. And so he came up with this idea, and he started to, you know, announce it. They formed an Iditarod Trail Committee. They already kind of had one left over from that short race that Dorothy Page was in on, and they started to announce it, and the word started to go out. They started to hold meetings, and I was in a whole bunch of those meetings. Actually, I was just like a fly on the wall back there. I couldn't really take part in them. I was busy making my motion picture, but I was raptly attending them and taking in all of the information. Anyway, he along the way, the date of March 1973 was put out there and announced in the Anchorage paper. And as the years went by and this winter of 72-73 came along, it was pretty evident to my buddy Ron Aldrich and me and some others, there wasn't enough being done to ever bring off a race like this. And by the way, the race was going to go from Kinnick to Iditarod and return. Kinnick to Iditarod and return. There was no idea of it going anywhere else.
And Rod, so, Rod, how far is that? Do you know in miles from Kinnick to Iditarod back then?
I'm going to throw, this is off the top of my head, it's within a few miles. I think it's like 808 miles.
Up and back. So 400 up, yeah, 400 yeah. back. Okay. So let me jump in here as we're leading up to the race there. I don't know if you know this, but my wife and I not only are owners of Mushing Magazine, but we're also the owners of Team and Trail. I'm sure you're very familiar with that publication back in the day. And we're currently scanning in every issue page by page. And it was so fun to read those early issues in the late 60s, early 70s as that led up and how it was reported on and, you know, all of the stories that were coming out of that in that publication. It's just amazing how much work was going on. Obviously, this is well before, you know, the mass media market that we have today and the grassroots sponsorships and all that, that we have, you know, with social media and everything, which is an entirely different world, literally and figuratively. But as we're rolling up to these first few years of Iditarod, how old were you when you met those guys on the lake? Early 20s?
I was probably 27 or 28. I was 3 weeks past my 30th birthday when I stood at the starting line of the first I did a run.
And what about the other guys? How old was Joe at that point? And Dan, were you the youngster of the group, or did you kind of fit in with those guys?
Well, anybody that showed interest fit in, but Joe, I guess Joe would have been 20 years at least older than I, 20, 25, something like that. Dan, who lamentably just passed, was about 4 years, I guess, older than I. Tom also maybe just a tad older. But I was about 30. You know what? Where I kind of wanted to go with this.
Yep.
As we progressed, is Joe was very excited about this race. Again, there wasn't enough going on that it could have been pulled off. We could sort of see that. And then all of a sudden, along come Tom Johnson and Gleo Hike. Gleo was the president of the Aurora Mushers, and so it's not like they came out of nowhere. It's that they were on a buying trip to Anchorage one day in the fall of that momentous winter to buy dog food, and they were talking with each other, and they were talking about how this thing just wasn't going to come off,
right? Unless
somebody helped. And they got more and more excited, and they got so excited they called Joe from Anchorage. Now, this is very, very key. This is very key. They talked about it with Joe. They offered to help him bring it off as it had been advertised, March 73. And Joe's words were, "Really? Do you think we can actually do it?" Okay, that's very important. Because without Gleo Hike and Tom Johnson, there would have not been any Iditarod race then or ever.
Interesting.
And I can get into that as we go along. It had to be 73 or it could have never happened. There was a giant paradigm shift going on, and it's still going on today, tapering off. But trending away from the use of dogs, and so they just tore into this thing like crazy. And in November of that year, Joe said, "Look, Dorothy has not been supportive." As he and I talked, as we worked together out on the mouth of the Yukon a few years later for a summer, he said, "When the pages heard me talk of the long race, they ran like rabbits."
Oh, my goodness.
And so Joe said to Tom and Gleo, they were meeting about every night. Tom was an English teacher, and Gleo, a storied band leader in their high schools. And Joe said, "Let's go over to the pages one more time and try one more time to bring Dorothy on board. She did so much work in this bringing off this 1967 race, which was the greatest race in history leading up until that time, as far as number of participants and prize money." And Tom and Gleo just kind of looked at each other and rolled their eyes and kind of went, "Okay, Joe." Well, they go over to the pages, and they were told in no uncertain terms, Dorothy said, "Do not join our name to this race in any way." Her famous words were back then. A lot of people knew them. I don't know if it came out in the Frontiersman or some publication or not, but everybody in the dog mushing community and around the Wasilla area knew her words. "I wash my hands completely of this race." Yeah. And so it wasn't until a few years later when a new reporter came to Alaska and thought he had a hook and a great story when he made up the story of Iditarod has a mother. What Dorothy could have done was maybe held a press conference and say, "Listen, when people talk about the Iditarod race, nobody remembers the short centennial race. They think of it as a long race. And so they think I was, she could have said that, but she never did. And she rode that all of her days.
Interesting.
And so anyway, that's one, when I decided to write my books on the Iditarod and contacted Glio and his wife and so forth, the first things out of their mouth was, they said, Rod, I hope you fix the Dorothy Page thing.
So
yes, there we go. That's out there for you to use however you want.
I like that. I don't think a lot of people know that history. It's just associated because, as you said, stories get told and so on. Rod, let's go back to what it was like in the dog mushing community in those early days of the race. So, you know, 67 to 73. I was only 2 years old in 1973. I got into dog mushing in 1994. So I'm about 20-ish years after this time. And of course, I know the history as much as I possibly can, but I don't know the inner workings. What was the dog community like back in the late 60s, early 70s? Because as you said, snow machines were coming on board. Society was changing quite a bit in various fronts. So we could get political if we had to. But, you know, the world was definitely changing at that point in time in history. But what was it like in the community? Did they have, the division that we have now between the sprint mushers and the long distance? Did they have an outturning at the Rondi? Was dog food too expensive for everybody like it is today? What were the dogs like? Did everybody have 100 dogs? Tell me what the community was like in those early days.
Well, do you want me to go into the bush paradigm shift, or do you want me to just talk about dog mushing around Anchorage and the rail belt here?
Let's talk about what it's like here, and then in a future episode, I'm sure we're going to jump into this to the bush side for sure.
Oh, okay. Yeah, everything, of course, was sprint mushing. And here in the Anchorage area is the biggest club in the world, I would guess. And certainly it was back then. And out of, I think there were about 400 involved, including kids with the one doggers and the three doggers and so forth. And out of them all, I was the only one that showed a glimmer of interest in this race. It was an oddball thing. Almost everybody thought it would not come off. I was a good friend of Dick Tozier's. I didn't live very far from him, and a lot of times in the wintertime, he had somebody over at his house almost every night, a group of guys talking dogs. Dick would sit there sewing his dog collars that he sold for $1 a piece, and we just talked dogs. Orville Lake was his most regular, Orville just ran down the race. He didn't have much good to say about Joe. And he and Earl Norris were always kind of edgy toward each other as well. Earl didn't think much of the Iditarod. Nobody thought it was going to come off. And Dick though, never badmouthed it like the others. He just very respectably said, Rod, I don't see how it can be brought off. Look at the trouble we have just putting in the rendezvous trail, where you can eat breakfast at home and drive out to wherever you're going to work on the trail and walk a little ways or drive the dogs out or snow machine out and work on your section of the trail, go home at night. And we've got all these volunteers right here, no logistics to worry about, no expense, just volunteer help. How in the world is he going to get 1,000 miles of trail put in? He said, I noticed there's a few trappers and homesteaders kind of puttering around on this end of it, trying to find the old trail and try to put it in. And they're not getting very far. As they get farther and farther out, it'll be more expensive. And he said, where's he going to get the prize money? And this is a kind of a morphodite, I was going to use the word bastard child or something, but anyway, it was so irregular were all of the dog mushing models that had been going on, which are all sprint pretty much. I mean, there had been longer distance stuff in the past, but nothing like this. I mean, if you think of the All-Alaska Sweepstakes out of Nome, they went up a telegraph line between the Seward Peninsula's two biggest towns, a well-traveled telegraph line with way stations along there, shelter cabins. And man, you could go out and stock your drops by taking training runs. And it was just virtually nothing to put on compared with this trail to Kinnick, from Kinnick to Iditarod and return.
The world was sprint, obviously. We talk about the Rondi. Of course, this was the reign of, George Atla and Doc Lombard and all those guys who we know about in history, of course, on that side of the sport. And you'd mentioned the Alaska Sweepstakes, which was held obviously far from here as the crow flies. You'd mentioned in Nome. How did people get excited about it? If everybody's running sprint dogs, what did it take to get these folks, other than the grizzled veterans, like you said, with Joe and of course Dan and all those guys later on? But how did you sell it to the mushing public? Not necessarily logistics or money or any of that. How did you get the people on board, the people that were actually going to participate in it?
There were guys like me that were just adventurers.
Right.
And this thing was so audacious. And it was so grandiose. In a way, it was absurd. And it just appealed to a kind of an adventurous spirit. And it really didn't appeal to too many people that had been sprint racers. Dick Mackey was a great exception, and some of the native drivers like Isaac Oklisik. But mainly it was a kind of an offbeat group of non-joiners, oddballs, and that's pretty much the way the sprint racers looked at us. We were just kind of of an odd community unto ourselves. And all of the seeming expertise was in the side of the sprint racing community. And we were just out there as kind of strangers, associated strangers, I guess, to those people.
And that's how they sell it today still, right, Rod? I know we're going to talk about what leads up from the beginning of the race to today and beyond in a upcoming episode, but it's still sort of sold that way as this huge adventure, out there in the wilderness, pick you up by your bootstraps, all of that sort of stuff. It's still this grand adventure, right?
No, I don't look at it as much of an adventure at all anymore.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about that without spoiling what we're going to talk about in the next couple episodes.
Right. If you think about the dictionary definition of adventure, it involves risk, hazard, chance, a possible unknown outcome, perhaps failure, an undertaking into the vast unforeseen. And I'll tell you, it couldn't be more different today and before the first race. Not more different at all.
Right.
You think of the thousands upon thousands of trips over the Iditarod Trail now that have been made. There is one whale of a universe of difference between doing something that you've never done before and doing something that neither you nor anyone else in world history has ever done before. This was the Lewis and Clark expedition of the Iditarod.
Yeah.
And following that came sort of like wagon train trips over the Oregon Trail. And following that came today's parallel to a highway race between Independence, Missouri and Astoria, Oregon. And so back in the early days, the big thing was, can you even make it to Nome?
Yeah.
And that was a big thing for years on the Iditarod. Just, can you even make it? That was parallel. That was kind of right alongside, with what what place you can take in the race. Can you be competitive? But the big thing was just making it all the way.
Yep.
And so it was a big deal when I'm the only living founder of the Official Finishers Club, which wasn't called that at first. It was called Anchorage Gnome Iditarod Mushers. If you look at the patch that I produced, that's, you'll see that name on the patch, Anchorage to Gnome Iditarod Mushers. It was a big deal about making it to Nome. Now you get the patch.
So let's talk about the logistics of the race here before we run out of time on our first episode. As you know, Rod, you've been doing this for a very long time. Any type of race is subjugated to the people that are able to organize it, put it on, the logistics side of it. I've been involved with clubs since I've been involved with dog mushing. And it's usually that very small hand group of people that come together to make this happen. Whereas the people that are actually participating, they just hope that those people are doing their job, you know, the logistics and all of that. What was that like? What was the planning portion of this? Because you told the story about Dorothy Page and you guys meeting up and you didn't know if it was going to happen. How did this sort of come to fruition? You said there was a monumental moment there in 1973. Was that the snow machine? Was that the political climate of Alaska? What was that big push for 1973?
It had to be 73. It could have never happened any other year. And if it hadn't happened then, it would have never, ever happened. And here's why. We had General Geddes. Now, I count five people that I count if not for these five, there would have been no Iditarod race as we know it. If you don't have Joe Reddington, no Joe, no race. I'm quoting LaVon Barvey on that one. You can't put it more succinctly. No Joe, no race, period. But then no Tom Johnson and Gleo Hike making that phone call and dedicating their winter, no 1973. No 1973, no General Geddes. While here, the general who was one of the most powerful generals in the United States, head of the whole Pacific Command, he developed a love for dog mushing. And Dick Tozier sometimes would set him up with a little team out at his place, and he'd come out and drive dogs out on Campbell Airstrip, kind of wash his mind of the pressures running the base, but he loved dog mushing. And Joe had this wonderful connection with the military because of all of his work. And anybody wants to read about Joe, Katie Mangelsdorf's book, Joe Reddington, Champion of Alaska Huskies, she tells all about that. And so he had this in with the general, and he approached the general about putting in the trail. Now, we who know about it realize it was the U.S. Army that put in the original Iditarod Trail back in 1910 and 11. They had a division called the Alaska Road Commission. So it was kind of a natural that if the trail's going to be put in again, it's going to, you know, why, who better than the Army? And the other thing is 1973 being important here with these two bases, Fort Richardson and Elmendorf. One year, the Army general is over the Air Force general as top guy. The next year, vice versa. Well, 1973 was General Geddes' year. Next was General Marks. He didn't give a rip about the Iditarod. And would have never happened. This thing, who knows how many millions of dollars in today's dollars were put into that. It's a huge part of Iditarod history that has been ignored. I have not been able to get anybody with the U.S. Army interested in plumbing the depths. There must be files on that or something. They had so much air-to-ground cover, big snow machine expedition, and you couldn't even find most of the miles of the trail. They had defined routes and put it in. The civilians that were working on it on this end could have never, ever, ever pulled it off. And so it had to be 1973. The other The other person, and we'll probably get to this another time, was Bill Weimer. Now, the race could have gone on from Connect to Iditarod and return without him, but he's the guy that brought off they had to override Joe Reddington. He was really loyal to that Connect to Iditarod and return model. But anyway, it was Bill Weimer that forced the vote that changed it to go from Anchorage to Nome. And of course, that was the golden key. And Joe wasn't really happy about it at first, but by the time Bleo and Tom and Joe returning home from the Anchorage meeting got to about the Kinnick River Bridge, they had him convinced. And if you read Dick Mackey, the book by Lou Friedman, 1 Second to Glory, about Dick Mackey, Dick tells about getting a phone call at midnight from Joe, and it was that night, and Joe by then was excited and said, "Dick, we're going to Nome." And I got a letter from Ron Aldrich. And back then there was no telephone up to Montana Creek. And that letter, I wish I'd have retained that letter. And it said, "Rod, Joe says we're going to Nome." So the five, if not fours, were Joe, Tom and Gleo, General Geddes, Bill Weimer.
Very interesting. And you had mentioned that that the command shifted, I guess is the proper term for that, from Air Force to Army and back and forth. And just a little bit of a up-to-date nugget, we still play games, I guess you would, with the base over in the Chugiak area when we're trying to use trails and, you know, run close to the base and all that. So there's still that relationship that has to be developed here all these years later. But as you said, the Army was in command there, and they did a lot of work with putting in the trail way back in the early days, in the early 1910s. What was the, I know this is a little bit in the weeds, but what was the reasoning for them doing that? What was the Army's reason for putting that trail in? Was it strategic on the Army side? Was it so transportation could happen? I'm not familiar.
The U.S. Army sent up, I think, Captain, I'm not sure his rank, Ray, to look over the situation when there was a huge food shortage with the Klondike Gold Rush. Okay. And they forecast that starving people of all ranks and honesties, we're going to go out and maraud and just raise Cain because they were starving. And it was going to cause lawlessness. And they sent him up to look over the situation. And they thought one of the weaknesses up here is there's no communication. There's no roads. There's no trails. We need to work up a system. And they thought roads and trails were strategic. Mm-hmm. So they formed this Alaska Road Commission under Wilds Richardson, you know, of Richardson Highway ilk. Anyway, so along came a number of years later, the Iditarod Gold Rush. But actually before then, Nome was wishing for a shorter mail route. And they could see that the straight shot through between Nome and Seward, which was the most northerly ice-free port, that was so much shorter. At first, of course, Nome was going for its mail through Dawson and through the White Pass and the Chilkoot Pass down to Skagway for its mail. I mean, what, 2,400 miles or something like that?
Yeah.
And then it got shortened when the Fairbanks strike came along, and Fairbanks found that route of the Trans-Alaska pipeline down to Valdez. But that's still a long ways to go for no mail. It was like 1,100, 1,200 miles or so. And they could see, man, we can have a straighter shot. The problem was they came up with the idea after most people had folded their tents and left, and Nome had settled from its maybe 20,000-30,000 on the Seward Peninsula down to a more developmental stage of the gold mining, and Nome had maybe 3,000 population. And then the Iditarod strike occurred. Oh, Goodwin was sent out. Colonel Goodwin was sent out from the Nome office of the Road Commission to look over the route in 1908. And he did so, and he said, you know, it'd make a good route and everything. There's just no call for it. Not enough call for it. It's through wilderness. It's out of the line of travel, which was between the great gold strikes of the interior. And it just doesn't make sense. You'd have to subsidize roadhouses, and nobody's going to put up a roadhouse when there's no traffic. There was really no reason to go through to Seward, hardly at all.
And that's where you're getting that, if you're looking on the map, that's where you get that very typical diagonal route, of course, now that is the Iditarod route,
right,
from Nome down to Anchorage and, of course, south to Seward. Rod, we're just about out of time here. We've told the story pretty much up from those early days of the early meetings of Joe and the crew thinking about the race. We haven't run the race yet. That's going to be on part two of this series. But leading up to that, is there one final story you want to tell before we close?
I just want to clear up one thing of importance. By the way, I was appointed by the Secretary of the Interior under Carter to the very Cecil Andrus to the very first Iditarod National Historic Trails Advisory Council, and I've written the book Trailbreakers: Pioneering Alaska's Iditarod. Volume one is about the creation of the trail. Volume two about the race. But anyway, I wanted to correct one thing you said about the trail going to Nome. It did not go to Nome. That trail was already way in. In fact, if you read history, say Stepan Adney, I believe Stepan, but anyway, he talks about, and other people talk about, when Nome was discovered, all of a sudden, in virtually a month's time, 8,000 people blasted out of Dawson and the Klondike area, headed for Nome. I would say that maybe those 8,000 going over the Caltag Portage and up the coastal trail to Nome maybe surpassed all the rest of the passages of the trail in all the years afterward. Those trails were so priorly put in that the Iditarod Trail, when you read Gudrun's report of his putting in the trail in 1910 and 11, he talks about when they got to Caltag and crossed the river, then the trail work began. So right. The trails were already in. The Iditarod Trail proper, if you want to speak properly, goes between Seward and the Yukon River. Okay. And then it joins other trails. So the Iditarod race runs over part of the Iditarod Trail between this area and the Yukon. Then it climbs on the Yukon River Trail. And then it climbs on the Caltag Portage Trail. And then it climbs on the coastal trail up to Nome. So four trails make up the race trail.
And of course, all of those trails, as you mentioned, Rod, of course, they were used well back into history, of course.
Way back.
Transportation, mail, supplies. I mean, we're talking well before Alaska was Alaska, that was happening. I guess my point to that was when they thought about that that shot from Seward to Nome, I was just thinking on the map how the trail looks now, where they were trying to, instead of going the river route, as you mentioned, from Dawson up the Yukon and on, they were trying to figure out, like you said, a shorter way, right?
Right.
Okay, gotcha. Okay. Hey, this is going to be an awesome series, guys. I'm looking forward to having Rod on. We're planning on 3 or 4 episodes. It's really going to lead up not only from this early stages of Iditarod's planning, but of course, Rod's experience with the race up to this point today. Here we are in 2026. And then what's going to happen later? We're going to talk a lot about the Mushing District that is brand new in Anchorage. It's an amazing site that's really kicking off this year as we lead into Rondi and Iditarod. It's going to be a fun, fun series. Rod, I have a few questions I ask all of my guests. Are you ready for them?
Well, yeah, we'll hope there's any depth to my answers, but go ahead.
Okay, so here we go, Rod. The first question I ask everybody is, what are you listening to? I know you're not much of a radio guy anymore, but if you had to put something on the stereo, in your headset, whatever it is, what is the genre, artist, song? What's your favorite?
Oh, doggone. I'm a kind of a child of my age. I'm 83 now. I really, when I get on the treadmill, I like 50s, 60s rock the most.
Do you have a favorite?
Oh, I don't know. It'll take a while to think of one.
Okay, so let me ask you this. If we're talking 60s, are we talking Elvis? Are we talking Rolling Stones?
Oh, not Rolling Stones at all.
No, okay.
No, it would be more Elvis and those guys.
Okay. All right. Because there's usually a division there, right? Typically, we have in the 70s, late 60s, 70s, we have either the Rolling Stones or the Beatles or the Beatles or Led Zeppelin or something like that, if you get my drift.
Yeah, definitely none of those.
Okay, gotcha. All right, so the next question is, what is one piece of gear you always have with you, whether it's on the trail, in your pockets as you're running around town, something other than a cell phone? What are you carrying around?
Well, you know, a well-dressed man in my day wasn't dressed until he put his wallet in his pocket and his jackknife.
Okay. And, I'm still a wallet in my pocket guy, so I hear you there.
Yeah. So I usually try to put a jackknife in my pocket.
Okay.
If I'm going out at all into the outdoors, I have a private little mixture that I make up, a dynamite fire starter that'll start when it's sopping wet and get anything going. So I always have that in my pack.
Okay. And you said private, so we're going to keep it private. You don't have to divulge all the secrets. Okay. Next one is a two-parter.
I was going to say, my kids were always asked what was in it. And I told them, just tell them there's Wolverine sweat in the formula.
You're sort of like Colonel Sanders in the Kentucky Fried Chicken. You're keeping it close to the vest. All right. Okay. Next one is a two-parter here, Rod. This can harken back to your days as a dog musher. What was your favorite trail meal or snack? And then the second part of this is, if you're traveling on the road and you're heading to a sled dog race, or in your later years, maybe visiting family or whatever, and you're pulling up to the gas station or truck stop, what are you picking up? It's a two-parter.
Well, out on the trail, I like to take a balanced meal. Of course, those races of mine, holy smoke, that first one, Robert, took me 30 days to battle my way through to Nome. And we can talk about why in a future episode. But anyway, you just need to have a fairly balanced diet over a trip that long. But then, doggone, I found I needed a lot of calories. So sometimes I had what my body needed as far as nutrition, but I had throw it out of balance by eating great big fist sized chunks of fudge, the homemade fudge. And okay. Also my mom had this wonderful, wonderful concoction made of all kinds of dried fruit, about every kind you can think of, ground together with nuts and whole oranges, peel and all, and bound together with that orange juice and honey. And so what I've find is, a lot of times things like freeze-dried food and that lacks a lot of vegetable material.
Yep.
And lacks fat. But anyway, that was pretty much. And then as far as stops along the way, I'll throw you an unusual one. I have a lot of trouble getting enough sleep at my age. So if I'm traveling now, not necessarily way back in the day, but when I'm traveling now, what I'm doing is I'm buying some smoking hot peppers.
Oh.
And I eat those babies, and I'm sweating, and the tears are coming down sometimes, and my mouth's burning up, and I ain't going to sleep at the wheel.
So you're just munching on them like carrots then?
Yeah, just nibbling right through a jar of them.
Oh my goodness! Do you have a favorite pepper? Is it a jalapeno? Is it a poblano? What is it?
Poblanos are too mild.
Okay,
I mean, I like to eat those too for other things, but I usually get jalapenos.
Okay,
maybe even a little bit of ghost pepper in there or something.
You know, Rod, I've been doing this for a long time. I think we've been doing this podcast 15, 16 years now. And I don't think anybody has said they just drive down the road popping peppers. So that's a new one for me.
I've heard that breath spray sprayed in your armpits do a pretty good job, too, of keeping you awake.
Okay. Well, there you go. From the man himself, Rod Perry is our guest on this short run series. Rod, it's a pleasure. I'm so happy we're able to connect. Looking forward to our next episode. You take care, okay?
Okay, good, Robert. This has been fun.
Thank you. On behalf of my guests, this is Robert. We'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.
Are you a fan of the great outdoors? Do you enjoy the thrill of speed and adventure? Then listen up. Introducing Mushing, your ultimate guide to the exciting world of dog-powered sports and mushing. Whether you're a seasoned musher or just starting out, Mushing has got you covered. Get ready to immerse yourself in captivating stories of incredible sled dog races, expert training tips from seasoned professionals, and gear reviews to help you make the right choices for your team. From the breathtaking landscapes of Alaska to the snowy trails of Scandinavia, Mushing takes you on a thrilling journey through the world of dog-powered sports. Don't miss out on the latest issue, packed with exclusive interviews with top mushers, in-depth articles on sled dog nutrition, and stunning photography that will transport you to the heart of the action. So whether you're dreaming of competing in the Iditarod or simply want to learn more about this incredible sport, Mushing is your go-to resource. Subscribe now and get ready to unleash your passion for mushing. Visit our website at mushing.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. Mushing, where the spirit of adventure meets the power of the pack.